This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome once again to one of our curators' talks. We're delighted to run this series, and today we've got senior curator Martha Sears. So, and today the talk is on a very interesting subject. It's about positive photographic plates. We just had a talk with Martha, and she said they're not negative, they're positive photographic plates.
And we're very positive here at the museum. And that, we don't have any negative plates in our
collection. Nothing negative here at the National Museum. So these are plates that are taken in North Queensland by Richard Daintree. Daintree is acknowledged as one of the most significant photographers working in Australia in the 1850s and 1860s. He is also a pioneering geologist who is credited with attracting gold prospectors to North Queensland. This talk is part of the series, which I just mentioned. And the other thing that's been really wonderful about this series is that we actually have some artefacts for you to also look at. So I think it just makes the talks very much more exciting. It says, a collection of Daintree's photographs and geological specimens formed much of the Queensland's contribution to the 1871 Exhibition of Art and Industry in London. Much of this material was lost when the ship carrying Daintree and his family to England was wrecked. So I'm going to now hand over to Martha, who is going to tell us the whole story. So Martha, thank you so much.
Thank you. I'm
very much looking forward to the talk.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. Thanks, Carol. Thank you, everyone. Can I just start by thanking everybody who's contributed to today, particularly the registration and conservation staff who've brought the objects out to Acton from Mitchell, and to Lennon, who's our photographer, but who's also brought his 1903 plate camera for us to have a bit of a look at a bit later. So I'd just like to tell you about this collection of glass plate positives by Richard Daintree. This is a collection that for the National Museum has been 25 years in the making. In 1982, a set of 10 glass plate positives that bore images of North Queensland in the 1860s and 70s that were taken by Richard Daintree came up for auction in London. There was considerable interest from all across Australia. The fledgling National Museum of Australia, then only 2 years old, decided that it would bid on the plates. There was some really vigorous bidding at the auction house in London, and in the end, the museum lost out. The plates were purchased by two Melbourne journalists who were planning to run a limited edition print set of the plates. After the auction, the museum contacted the journalists and explained that they'd been the underbidder and demonstrated that they were interested in them. And there was a bit of discussion that went backwards and forwards about the possibility of the material eventually coming to the museum. But in the end, the correspondence kind of petered out, and the collection file that related to the museum's sort of failed effort to try and grab the material went back on the shelf. But in October 2006, Rowan Henderson, who was the duty curator at the museum at the time, received a call from one of those journalists asking whether we were still interested in the plates 25 years later. The answer, of course, was yes. So that collection file came back off the shelf, and 25 years after we were first interested in the collection, we were able to successfully negotiate for the plates to come into the museum's National Historical Collection. And right on cue, Rowan Henderson, the duty curator who took the call. So what is this new collection that's been added to the museum's National Historical Collection? So the collection consists of 10 glass plate positives that are housed in a specially made wooden box. The images were taken by geologist, grazier and photographer Richard Daintree in Queensland between 1864 and 1870. They depict the miners and their families and at the diggings, Aboriginal people, islander labourers, posing in locations such as creek beds, diggings, settlements and missions. And something that's quite notable in the plates is worth looking out for. There's generally a dog in one of the pictures. I don't know whether that was a deliberate thing, but just maybe there were lots of dogs in Queensland at the end of the 19th century. And most of the dogs are little blurs. They don't sit still as well as the people. So currently we're researching this collection. The plates are unusual in several ways, and we're trying to work out what this means. So I just want to let you know that the research you're hearing about today is very much a work in progress. And it's going to be fantastic to perhaps get some of your thoughts and views today on some of the little things that are puzzling us about this collection. I just also want to acknowledge that much of what I'll say today owes a considerable debt to the research of other people. And researchers like Geoffrey Bolton, Ian Sanker, Judith Mackay, John Thompson, Helen Ennis, Ian Coates, Alan Davies, Peter Quatermain, and some curators at the Museum Victoria have all contributed in some way to the knowledge we have about Richard Daintree, and I just want to recognise their contributions before I launch into my talk. The other thing, I guess, to note is that many of the insights that we've gained around this collection have emerged through discussion, standing around the plates or standing in the office and trying to talk things through with other people. So I'd really like to thank David Parker, who's the conservator who's worked on the collection, Lannan Harley, who photographed the collection, and we had a great day working together on the material, George Serres, Lena Hall, who's done a lot of work around 19th century photography, Rowan, of course, Bromwin from the Circa team, who did some research, Kirsten Wayner and Christopher Pratt from the library. So much of what I'll talk about today is, as you can understand, the sum total of a large number of people's thinking and work and contributions. I just want to acknowledge that before I start. I also want to just let you know that my knowledge of Daintree comes because I'm an exhibition historian. I'm a historian of the world's fairs that he made such a significant contribution to towards the end of the 19th century. And I'm still learning. I'm a new chum when it comes to photographic technologies. So many of you may have knowledge that we can draw on and to help understand the plates, and feel free to bring that knowledge to the fore. So besides the beauty of the images on the plates, and this is just one example that you can see over here, there are some things that make the plates even more interesting than your average run-of-the-mill glass plate negative. And the first thing is that whilst they're Queensland subjects, the plates were found in London. So there's some thinking around, well, how do these plates end up in London and what were they doing there? Secondly, the plates are positives, not negatives. And all of the other Daintree surviving glass plates are glass plate negatives. So we're just thinking through, what does it mean for these to be positives? Secondly, in their physical appearance, they're very different to the other glass plate negatives that Daintree took. They feature some warping in the collodion and other aspects of them that make them stand out from the remainder of his other work. So another little puzzle. And then a small piece of the puzzle is that on the whole, these 10 plates feature human beings and animals. And Daintree was much more, overall, he was much more interested in landscape and geology. So for some reason, someone has gone to the effort of producing these positives, but particularly focusing on that subject matter which is of humans or animals. So that's quite intriguing. So what I'm going to do today is introduce you to Daintree himself, take you briefly through the wet collodion photographic process, and explore some of the ways that Queensland endeavoured to use photographs to promote itself internationally in the 1870s. And I guess then ultimately round back to some of the questions that we have about the plates themselves. So who was Richard Daintree? Here he is. I guess to sort of sum up Daintree's life, he lived between 1832 and 1878. He was born in Huntingdonshire in England, the son of a farmer. He matriculated at Christ College, Cambridge in 1851, but because of ill health, he left England in 1852 to join the gold rush to Victoria. Like many people, he was an unsuccessful prospector, but in 1854, he accepted a role offered to him by his friend Alfred Selwyn to join the Victorian Geological Survey, and he served with them over quite a long period of time. In 1856, he decided to return to England and further some of his studies. He studied assaying, but he also became interested in photography. And in England in 1856-57, he learnt how to make wet collodion photographs. And he then returned to Australia, sort of filled with the excitement and the possibility of what could happen here. And he worked with another significant early Australian photographer named Antoine Forcheret. And they developed a volume of photographic studies. This is a very familiar image from that set of diggers that they modestly, as Baz Luhrmann has, entitled Australia. So their book, Australia, was very popular and contained sort of significant early images of the, particularly Victoria. Daintree also returned to Victoria in the 1850s with his new wife, whose name was Lettice, and she followed him around a lot on his work, and he travelled all around Victoria as a field surveyor with the Geological Survey. And I guess the really striking thing about Daintree's work is that he chose to use photography to further his geological activities. So where other geologists spend a lot of time painstakingly sketching geological formations, Daintree used photography to document them. So I'll just show you a sequence of other interesting photographs. This one has a great title, Upper Paleozoic Resting Unconformably on Lower Ordovician. So a sequence of images. He was extremely interested in the relationship between rocks of the coast and the ocean. He took sequences of photographs of different sedimentary layers and other formations in the rock, and also unusual things like when a meteorite landed in Cranbourne in 1862. He also took photographs of fossils and other geological specimens. And as Geoffrey Bolton argues, I think his work is one of the very first applications of the camera to scientific fieldwork anywhere in the world, which is quite an achievement, I think. But just whilst Daintree was regularly photographing geological formations with a view to their economic potential for Victoria, I think he was not blind to the impact that mining would have on the very landscape that he'd photographed so majestically. And this image shows the diggings at Black Hill in Ballarat and sort of show the degree to which the working over of the country significantly altered what Australia's landscape would be like. He also interestingly took a sequence of panoramic photographs using a specially designed curved plate camera which had a water-based lens. And if you're interested in that, then that is an item in the collection of Museum Victoria. So if you ever get a chance to see it down there, grab it. Daintree gained a reputation in his profession as being, quote, amiable, warm-hearted, generous, quick in piercing geological problems, persevering, a hard worker, original in his views and tolerant of views that did not accord with his own. And he became quite a popular person within the Victorian community. But he was getting really bored with his job. It paid a really handsome £500 a year, but he was kind of hungry to do something more, and he'd gained such a degree of experience that he felt that he would like to start directing some of the geological work rather than simply being the field surveyor out in the wilds taking his photographs and documenting different rock formations. So in 1864, he decided to leave the survey and become a resident partner with William Hann, who was a friend, in pastoral properties in the new Burdekin country of North Queensland. So in Queensland, Daintree then undertook a series of years where he ran the pastoral properties, indulged his interest in photography, but also persisted in his exploration of Queensland from a geological point of view, particularly with a view to opening up gold fields. And he, following a pastoral boom in the mid-1860s, he was able to use his knowledge to open up gold fields at Cape River in 1867, at the Gilbert in 1869, and at Etheridge in 1869-70. And those gold fields helped save Queensland from the Depression, which was a quite significant contribution for him to have made. I think it's also worthwhile that he advocated a geological survey of Queensland rather in the style of the one he'd participated in Victoria. And in 1868, he was appointed the geologist in charge of that survey for the Northern Division in the 1870s. And many of the images that you see, and almost all of the ones that are on the plates that we have, date to that period around 1870 when he was pursuing the survey in North Queensland. So it's worthwhile just trying to think through what taking photographs in far north Queensland in the late 1860s and 70s was like. And to do that, we need to have a quick understanding of the photographic process and its development. The wet collodion process was, I suppose, maybe the second major photographic innovation of the 19th century, the first being the daguerreotype, which was a silver-plated copper sheet, which was then exposed to the light and a silvery image appeared on the surface. This was sort of announced in 1839 and became the standard photographic process. But in 1851, Frederick Scott Archer announced a new process, the wet collodion process, which would have significant advantages over the daguerreotype. What made a wet collodion photograph different to this image, which is, as you can see, a silver daguerreotype? The main things that separated wet collodion photography were that it could produce a negative. So the production of a negative allowed the possibility of making many copies of an image from a single plate, usually by direct contact between that plate and what they called albumen paper, which is a paper that's been coated in egg white and silver nitrate. So the exposure of that, all of those elements together, would produce a photographic image. Wet collodion photography was 20 times faster than daguerreotype, but much more difficult to manage. The reward for the difficult process was that it had an extremely high degree of sensitivity and produced very delicate detail. So how do you produce a wet collodion photographic negative? In essence, a photographic negative was developed using a glass plate. So if you imagine the glass plate, which had been coated in a substance called collodion. Collodion is a gummy, creamy emulsion that's created by dissolving gun cotton in chemical ether. And chemical ether, as you'd be familiar, is both a solvent and an anaesthetic. So here's, on the left, you can see gun cotton being produced. So gun cotton is cotton wadding, which is saturated with various nitrates, and it's highly explosive. And if you dissolve gun cotton in ether, it produces collodion, and that crunchy, filmy substance on the right is the collodion. From the 1840s, collodion had been used as a wound dressing, so you could paint it on to a wound and it would cover up like a plaster. But eventually people realised that it would be a useful material for photography as well. So I have a wet plate collodion photography is coming back in vogue. Photographers who are working in the world of the digital image, which is made up of binary code and doesn't have a physical form, are finding themselves drawn back to the physical and mechanical qualities of working with light and plate photography. And so if you go online and hunt around, just put it into YouTube, wet collodion, you'll get a sequence of films that are made by photographers today who are explaining the process. Now, I've got one of those films to show you. But it, unfortunately, is going to be without sound. So I'm going to do the commentary on the wet plate collodion process. The photographer, this is a really good video, and I can give you the link if you want to see it. The photographer is a very well-known collodion photographer. At this point, he describes how all of the chemicals that are used to make collodion photographs are very volatile and dangerous, and that they require quite gentle handling and a considerable degree of understanding in order to make the plates work. The first stage of producing a wet plate photograph is to cut the glass. And plates came in a variety of sizes, and plate holders came in a variety of sizes. And they came in black glass and clear glass as well. But you could cut them to your own size. You then need to take your plate and deburr it, so to take the edge off so it doesn't cut your hands, but also to create a ridge around the outside of the plate which allows you to flow the collodion and have it not drip off. As he says, the most prosaic part of the process is cleaning the glass, but if you don't clean the glass properly, all of the imperfections and the pieces of dust and dirt and everything else that's accumulated on the front will destroy or the image. This is the crucial part of the wet collodion process called flowing the plate. Collodion is spilt onto the surface of the plate, and then the photographer manipulates the collodion so that it never touches the same place twice, because if it does, it will produce ridging and other imperfections in the image. So the collodion is tipped in a very particular way, and then the residue is sent into the bottle again. So that's the tricky part that you have to learn if you're going to do this. Sensitising the plate involves exposing the plate to, I think, silver nitrate in a special box in the dark, in your dark room, so that you allow the nitrates to prime the plate. Then you fix the plate in the carrier in the back of the camera, which Lennon can show you a little bit later. And you then expose the plate to the image. That requires taking the plate cover off, the lens cap off the camera, and then putting the lens cap back on. You then go through a sequence of chemical processes to develop the plate, which, as with standard developing today, allows the image to finally appear. The plate then needs to be fixed in the second part of the process, and this photographer loves to allow the sitter to see the plate finally emerge, the image finally emerge from the plate. And this is obviously, as with most of these processes, quite a delicate moment. And then you end up with the resulting image. A photographer, I'll probably just stop it there. It's worth looking at this image. This is how a contemporary photographer was able to carry his equipment from place to place. The wet collodion process required the plates to be used within 2 or 3 minutes of their preparation. So it was not possible to prime the plates and then go to where you wanted to and take the shot. You needed to do that, all of the steps of the process that we've just seen in sequence, in real time, in about 5 minutes. So it's worth just thinking through what that might have meant for someone like Daintree, who needed to do this in the rather imperfect conditions of a bushland gold digging scene. First of all, you had to carry all your gear with you. This is a list of gear carried by a Scottish photographer in the 1850s. You can read that for yourselves. It basically adds up to about 55 kilograms of material, including all of the solutions and camera and the tripod and the tent that you had to carry to be a darkroom. So this is what all this stuff looked like. So if you can imagine Daintree carrying this, we understand that he carried this material through the country on pack horses, on bullock drays and in jinkas or sulkies. Just while we pause here, this is obviously the wet plate process. There is some very intriguing evidence within the Centennial Exhibition Catalogue of 1876, which refers to Daintree employing a dry process to produce some of his plates. Quote, in which the gum resin of one of the Australian eucalypts was used as a preservative mixture. So there's a little bit of work to be done on the materials analysis of his plates to find out whether he was employing Australian native materials in order to try and progress the photographic process, but that's a question still to be answered. So let's just compare these images that we have in our collection with the glass plate negatives that we know about. If you look closely at these images, there are a few things that make the image a little different to Daintree's other work. Firstly, they're positives. Most of the images show what appear to be tab marks, white tab marks in the corner of the image. I'm sorry it's a bit blurry, but can you see there's a tab up here? There's a tab. The central image appears to have ballooned. So on many of the plates, which I'll show you later, the straight line of the bottom of the plate has bulged in this sort of a fashion. The production of these plates seems very rushed. The collodion has been applied unevenly, so not as beautifully as that man did with his flowing. In some cases, it almost seems to have been brushed on. The imperfect flowing of the collodion is sort of evidenced by this sort of ridging or wood grain kind of effect on the bottom of the plate. Two of the images solarised when we photographed them, which could just tell us something about the amount of collodion that's on the plate. And almost all of the plates show a long white mark down the side, which could be a white mark, or it could be evidence of the plate being lifted in and out of the different solutions. Recently I went up to the Royal Historical Society of Queensland, which has 264 Richard Daintree glass plate negatives in these boxes. Now, I would show you a photograph of one of his glass plate negatives, but when I opened the box and saw the plates, I became afraid that I would break one taking it out. And I was left with the keys to the cupboard to sort of play. And I became so frightened that I would destroy Richard Daintree's photographic legacy that I only took one out. And my hands were shaking so much when I took the photograph of the plate that the plate's fuzzy and I can't show you the image. So I'm very sorry. I'm going to go back with conservators who have firm, steady grips and have a look at them more closely. None of the plates... having said that, I went through all of the boxes and looked closely at the surfaces of the plates as they were sitting in the boxes, and none of them show any of the characteristics of the plates that we have. So, a bit of a puzzle. We know these plates came directly from Daintree's family in England, so they represent the plates that he himself made and then used. So we're wondering whether the plates in our collection might have been copied from other plates or perhaps from prints. That could well explain the tab marks in the corner and some of the distortion in the image. There's certainly 19th century photographic manuals that I've consulted that talk about fixing prints for copying using tin strips in the corner. It's also possible that these images have been produced as part of a process of enlargement and reduction. So when the wet plate process was first introduced, it was really hard to... You couldn't produce enlargements or reductions. You had to shoot at the size you wanted the image to be in the end. And there were innovations in the 1850s and 60s around the use of solar cameras to produce duplicates and also enlargements and reductions of images. And in some of the material I've read about those, you read about them having spectral and chromatic aberrations. So it could be that we're looking at some kind of effort to copy material in imperfect conditions. But it's a question that still remains to be answered. And I've called several of my colleagues in the various libraries and photographic curators, and we're all just thinking through how this works. So we're also just keen to know why someone would make glass plate positives at this size. The main reason for producing a positive, you could see the image better, but you could also project through the image and have a nice slide presented on the wall. And that's how we're all familiar with lantern slides. But if you think of a lantern slides are about this big because it enables you to get a smaller light source to... you can use a smaller light source to project the image. But these are... as you can see, big. They're a standard glass plate size. So we just have to think through how, and you guys might have some ideas, about how you might use these images for projection and how you would actually achieve that in the 1870s with the variability of light sources they would have been using. So they're the things that are puzzling us about this collection. I'll just take you through the images now so you can get a sense of what are the 10 images that we're dealing with here. This is first image, which is two gold miners outside of Bark Hut, which is Daintree titled Morning Going to Work. We then have its companion image, Evening Slinging the Billy. This plate, unfortunately, was broken when it was copied in the 1980s. We've been able to make a copy photograph of it, but the plate itself is quite damaged. Note the dog. We also have two images that are the same, that show... I'll go to those in a minute. There's images of miners working in a gully with some tents in the background. And then there's these two images, which are the same image, but one is darker than the other, which show miners working gold diggings in... We think it's near Rockhampton. So this is the second copy image of the same one, which, again, I think reinforces the idea of these plates being copied. We have a group of miners outside a tent selling equipment, and unfortunately this image isn't quite as detailed. Lannan took a beautiful photograph of it, and he took all these photos, and they're amazing. But in the squanching it down into a small size, you can't see it as well. There's a gold cradle being sold with its price written on the side, but for some reason the two men are handing each other a boot. I don't know if anyone can answer that little puzzle. It's one of the smaller puzzles in the collection. We have an image of a distant shot of a camp with miners, women and I think some workings in the foreground. It's thought that these images that I've just shown you relate to Carawal near Rockhampton. They may be New Zealand Gully, which was part of the Cape River diggings that Daintree visited in the 1870s. We have another beautiful image of settlers outside a Bark Hut, and the little gent on the left has got a small white Jack Russell on his lap, but he's moved and smudged as well. And this was taken at Gympie. We know this was taken at Gympie. We have a photograph of what appear to be Islander workers on a plantation. Some people think this is an image of a mission. Others think that it's an image of people working on a plantation. And then finally, one of Daintree's favourite images, a group of bullocks harnessed up for work with one bullock lying down. He used this image repeatedly. It was one of his favourites. So the key to understanding these objects, or this collection, is to grasp the flexibility offered by the wet plate process and its ancillary printing processes. By the 1870s, from a single plate, someone could produce multiple prints, enlarging or reducing the image as they desired. They could incorporate images into publications like books and pamphlets. They could project the images in lantern slide presentations. And the impact of this new technology was that the same image could appear in many different forms. What we consider normal today, which is that an image is sort of infinitely reproducible, was revolutionary when Daintree was working with these photographs. And Daintree made good use of all of the possibilities that were made available to him by the wet place process when he returned to England in 1871. Daintree was keen to promote the idea of a school of mines and a geological museum in Queensland, and he'd, on the journeys, same journeys that he took these photographs, he also collected a wide range of mineral and fossil and geological specimens. Queensland was invited to participate in the London International Exhibition of 1871, and basically no one could think of what they should send. The English commissioners had said no raw materials should be sent, and people were just scratching their head and thinking, what can we send? Eventually they got permission to use raw materials, and Daintree came forward and proposed an exhibit that combined his geological specimens with his photographs, and the politicians of Queensland jumped at it. William Henry Walsh, who was the member for Maryborough, spoke up in Parliament and said, "Views of the goldfields were the right kind of information to practical diggers, to capitalists who would invest in mining undertakings. It would give them a proper idea of the nature of the goldfields to which it was sought to attract their attention." So the goal of exhibition work for colonies like Queensland in the 19th century was to draw immigrants and to draw investment. And Daintree provided Queensland with a unique opportunity to present itself, and the government invited him to personally go to the exhibition and set it up and be present to answer people's questions. So Daintree hurriedly assembled his specimens and photographic plates, dissolved his business partnerships, and with his five children and a pregnant wife, and he had a sprained knee. We have a letter from him saying, "You know, I finally got on the boat, but I was too wrecked to write to anyone because I had a sprained knee." So a little glimpse into just how he was feeling packing up and going back to England. They sailed on the Queen of the Thames from Melbourne in February 1871. Unfortunately, en route to England, the Queen of the Thames was shipwrecked off South Africa. Daintree and his family survived, but as Daintree wrote to his friend Clark, "I lost all my collection of specimens in the wreck and have not a single fossil to put my hands on. However, such is life. One can't have everything their own way in this world, and I'm resigned to my misfortune. It is lucky indeed that we escaped with our lives. I was fortunate in being able to save my negatives." So luckily Daintree was able to grab the negatives or salvage them from the ship, and he was able to take them to England and put together his exhibits. It's worth just pausing here to set Daintree's work at exhibitions in context. Beginning with the Great Exhibition, which was held in the Crystal Palace in 1851, which many of you may have heard of, international exhibitions were the kind of mammoth displays and events of the 19th century. Raw materials, manufactured goods, arts and technology, all displayed in gigantic temporary cities. And it's hard to underestimate their impact on global culture in the 19th century. So if you can imagine an event that draws 6 million people to London, or another one that draws people to Paris in 1867, 9 million people attended the Paris Exposition of 1867. So they're kind of the equivalent of the Olympic Games, Expo, the World Cup, the Football World Cup, all mushed into one big extravaganza. And as I said, international exhibitions were a crucial place where the young colonies of Australia could promote themselves to emigrants and and investors, and the Australian colonies were very enthusiastic and displayed at almost every international exhibition from the very first. Daintree was well aware of the merits of exhibitions. He was a particular exhibition enthusiast, and he wrote, "My confirmed opinion is that the impress of the eye, by means of systematised pictorial illustration and tangible material record of our own resources, combined, pictorial illustration and the material record of resources combined will do more to find us favour in the opinion of the emigrant and the capitalist than the writing of very many books and even very many lectures." Is after a curator's heart, I think, saying that. The Queensland exhibit in 1871 was a huge success, and later that year Daintree was appointed Agent General for Queensland, which allowed him to enthusiastically pursue a systematic and innovative program of promotion through a wide variety of mediums. And I think the success of Daintree's promotional work in the 1870s really stemmed from the very different display style that he brought to international exhibitions, one that made maximum use of the technology of photography. He was a geologist, so he applied geological arrangement to his displays, which, although he admitted lacked artistry, were readily appreciated by visitors who were more accustomed to the picturesque confusion of that was most common at international exhibitions, where you could see, you know, a stuffed wallaby and an embroidered tabletop cover and a wood specimen and a coal specimen and a photograph all displayed together without any apparent rhyme or reason. So Daintree decided he would bring a sensible, common sense geologist's approach to display. And he received enormous praise for this approach, which basically involved, as you can see in this illustration, the presentation of photographic images of a particular region in Queensland and then displaying in showcases in front of those images the geological specimens and agricultural produce that were associated with that region. So a very simple relationship between this is what the country looks like, this is what it produces. And this was a very welcome relief for many visitors, and one Londoner commented that this was great relief from the collections of dingy and ill-arranged colonial produce so often seen at expositions, which usually featured odd lots of dirty cotton, bits of wool, ore and stones, which one ought to appreciate but cannot. So here you see Daintree's organisation of exhibits at the 1872 London Exhibition, and just note the very large life-sized photographs that he produced of Indigenous people, which hang at the back there. They were photographs he'd taken in Queensland. This is the Queensland Annex in London in 1873. Again, even more obvious use of the photography and the showcases together. I'm sorry about the quality of this stereoscope image. This is Queensland at the Centennial International Exhibition in Philadelphia, which featured a giant obelisk, golden obelisk, to symbolise Queensland's riches in gold. So one of the features of Daintree's exhibits was very large format photographs, and he also chose to employ the new carbon printing process to produce them, which was patent. The patent was owned by the Autotype Printing Company in London. And then he had them over-painted in oil to give them a more striking appearance. They were then mounted on cards, or they were mounted on canvas, stretched across a frame and then framed. Several of these have survived. These are some that I saw at the John Oxley Library in Queensland about a month ago. These are the canvas-stretched version of them. They come in ornate golden frames. You can see the over-painting. See that this sort of slight difference in texture between the background photograph and the oil paint. The beautiful cows. and if you look at the back of them, you can see they've been used many, many times. The label here shows the framer in London, but there are hanging points for hanging here and here. There's another one there. The whole of the frame's been punctured numerous times. I think they've been used many, many times. So, and certainly Daintree's evidence, the written evidence, suggests that he used and reused them a lot. The interesting thing that does strike you when you look at these images is that the colouring has been done by someone who's never been to Australia. The different sets that are available, there's set in the Queensland Museum, a very extensive 150 of the calico, the canvas-mounted ones, plus a further 100 or so card ones. they have the most muted colourings. Here we see a very familiar image from our own plates, overpainted. Again, the same image overpainted, with the greenery looking oddly not very Australian. But these are the subtle, these are the sort of very subtle ones. These are the ones from the National Library. Again, oil on canvas, a photographic print, with the colours becoming a bit more lurid. This one, I think, is almost an oil painting. And when you see it, it sort of strikes you as being much more of the character of an oil painting than a photograph. And a photo of three Indigenous men fighting, which again looks like an oil painting. So the photographic process offered enormous detail, but I think Daintree was quite keen to draw out to sort of strike a balance between the oil paintings that visitors would have been familiar with to give a sense of the colour, but the impressive detail of the new technology as well. So here are just a few more. So again, you can just see how repeatedly Daintree used the same image and treated it in a slightly different way each time. Again, same image, different colouring. He also produced, using the same autotype process, very large albums of photographs. And these were available at exhibitions for people to flip through. So this is the title page of one of them. If you went to the Treasures of Australia's National Libraries, you would have seen one of these. There's two of them in the John Oxley Library. Again, the repeated use of the image. Here are our friends, the Bullocks. One more time. Group of Working Bullocks, Queensland. So Daintree's promotional scheme also included the integrated use of images in a variety of other forms, such as publications and slideshows. In 1873, he produced a book called Queensland, Australia, which offered a detailed account of the colony's geographical position, climate and resources, intended as a handbook for prospective emigrants and investors. In the book, Daintree used his photographs to detail the exact nature of the country, its productive capacities and its cost to purchases. So you would see an image like this, and underneath it would be captioned, first class pastoral land, 10 shillings an acre. He also uses several of the images that appear on the plates in our collection, so images that you're already familiar with, to illustrate what life might be like for prospective immigrants. To the farmer, he wrote, "The future agriculturalist will take care to select a small patch of the richest agricultural land, either alluvial scrub or volcanic. See photographs numbers 10, 3, 4 and 6. He will put up a slab hut, such as is here depicted, from timber off his own land, fence in his selection, and then it will be his own fault if he has not plenty to eat and drink." So I think in that case we might be talking about, say, that image. I think it's that image, actually. He then wrote to the miner, "The emigrant who intends to take his chance at the goldfields must not run away with the idea that fortune awaits him. He will probably be no better housed than the miners seen in this illustration." Sorry. I think it might be this one, actually. Sorry, that one. Which is, "who, however, it will be admitted, do not look as if their rough habitation or mode of life disagrees with them." Daintree also made copies of these photographs with information printed on the back that he could hand out to prospective immigrants who visited him or who attended exhibitions. So the final use that Daintree could make of these images was to use them in slideshows. And in 1871, he wrote back to the Queensland government suggesting that if his services could be retained when the exhibition building was closed, quote, "I could undertake to lecture in the agricultural and mining districts here and would provide myself with the apparatus for dissolving views, requiring only a few transparent slides of an agricultural and pastoral series to complete an exhaustive pictorial representation of the colony." This may be one of the most promising lines of inquiry in relation to the glass plates that we have in the National Historical Collection, which could have been used for projection. So the idea of a positive plate which could have been projected does start to accord with the idea of Daintree's dissolving views. But that's further work that we're going to have to do. So Daintree spent his life in the 1870s promoting Queensland at exhibitions and through the publications I've just told you about. But his role as Agent General included many, many more responsibilities. It included the supervision of emigration, the inspection of materials ordered for railways and other public works, the floating of government loans on what was a shark-infested London capital market, discussing mail and cable routes, entertaining visiting Queenslanders and a whole range of other small minor duties. Daintree was a very busy man and he entrusted much of this work to his staff, particularly his clerk, whose name was James Wheeler. Unfortunately, Wheeler repaid Daintree's confidence by making clandestine profits by sending contracts by way of certain businessmen. In one case, he earned a shilling a head for each migrant that Taylor and Company, the company paid to transport people to Queensland, could put in their ship. The value of the deal to him was £320, equivalent of a year's salary. In another incident, the company Percival, who were a Liverpool outfitter, who provided the emigrants with ship's kits, paid Wheeler 5% of the amount they received from the Queensland government to supply the kits, which they supplied for a pound, even though everyone knew that everywhere else they were available for 12 shillings. So Wheeler really systematically rorted the system. And the other staff under Daintree's management were not much better. They took up second jobs as passenger brokers and made money by taking fees from passengers who they were meant to be assisting. Daintree's job was difficult enough without all of these scandals, and he struggled to get a large number of suitable migrants onto the ships that his political masters demanded of him. Daintree had left England as a young man with weakened lungs under doctor's orders to seek a warmer climate. And under the tremendous strain of his job, his poor health began to fail. In 1876, he resigned from the position of Agent General, and he planned to devote the next 12 months of his life to his health and then to make science his recreation. However, although he went to France to try and soak up the sun, his health deteriorated and he died on the 20th of June 1878, aged 46. So his family maintained strong connections with Australia. He'd maintained strong connections with Australia. And certainly one of his sons came back to Queensland and worked on a pastoral property. And over time, Daintree's images also returned to Australia. So all of the images that you've seen here are in collections within Australia. And they've been coming back to Australia since the 1940s. I guess the final group to make it back to Australia that we know of were the glass plates negatives that we now have in the National Historical Collection. So just to conclude, I just wanted to, I guess today, draw out the way in which the glass plate process and the way that it could be used to reproduce multiple images in multiple forms opened an incredibly large range of possibilities to Daintree as someone endeavouring to promote Queensland in the rest of the world in the 1870s. From here on in, we've got some more research to do. We'd like to do a detailed reading of Daintree's correspondence and to track all of the movements of his plates and his references to photographic work. We'd like to do a materials analysis on the plates, not just to find out whether they use eucalyptus gum in some way, but also to just get more information at how they were made and used. And our conservation team will undertake that work. We'd also like to compare our plates and all of the plates and images that are available throughout Australia to understand how the images were made, when, where, and for what purposes. And we've been discussing a collaborative research project with our colleagues in Queensland and Victoria to pursue that. I guess this really reinforces that the lines of inquiry that we'd like to pursue around the plates can really only be fully undertaken by moving beyond looking at Daintree's photographs simply as images and engaging with them, as many historians of photography have expressed this idea, engaging with them as objects. The form, the materials, the wear patterns, and the marks on these plates and on the other surviving examples of Daintree's work tell us an enormous amount about how his photographic practice shaped not only his life and his experiences and his journeys through Queensland and Victoria, but also the ways in which he could feature Queensland and create an image of Queensland in the imagination of people in Britain, Europe and America in the late 19th century. I think without this particular process and without the particular form of the wet plate process, that none of that would have been available to him. If you look really closely at some of the plates in our collection, you can see the fingerprints of the plate maker. And I think it's amazing to think that these might be Daintree's fingerprints, a ghostly reminder of the person who made and used these beautiful photographic plates more than 135 years ago. Thanks, everyone. My pleasure.
For me, it really put a face to a name that we're all
familiar with.
Extremely familiar with, but also made, there's this nice little mystery left
there is.
To be discovered.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm not a photographer of that sort of calibre, but it's certainly a huge interest that's there ahead of us.
Yep.
So
we'll
now ask for some questions. And I'm going to have to ask you to speak into this microphone.
I would like to suggest that those slides were used in an epidioscope.
Uh-huh. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah, you can project. Use epidioscopes were in use before PowerPoints.
Yep. Hallelujah! Let's get one.
I have used an epidioscope to do a scientific lecture
about terrific.
40 years ago.
Yep.
I suspect that those are
it might be used
the right
for that.
Size
fantastic.
To fit on the plate of an epidioscope.
Brilliant.
Which
okay.
is a reflective process, not a projection.
Yep, okay, wonderful. I'll follow up on that. I'll also get you to write it down so that I spell it properly. That's really great. That's wonderful. It's certainly been puzzling. I've called several of the other photographic folk and they're puzzling over these plates, but that could be the answer, so we'll look forward to that. And put your name there so I can get back to you and let you know that you're right, hopefully.
Now, another question? I'm sure they don't all have to be technical.
No, not at all.
If you've got just a question about the man himself or his work or something like that.
Well, I was just going to say the Mikhailovits. That strikes me as something that he had in a book or on spare pages.
Yep.
And he'd have a print. And then he would continuously use
the
Mikhailovits.
Yep. Yep.
Yes, and you wouldn't take it off the background.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep, that's a good suggestion. Thank you, everyone, for coming and your interest, and it's been fun.
Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.